Welcome back to With All Due Respect. I'm Michael Jensen and I'm with Megan Powell-Dutoit. Welcome to the new year and it's great to see you, Megan, and it's great to see you listeners, though I can't see you.
One day you'll get past that.
Today, with the new year theme, we're looking at Franklin Graham, who's coming in February of this year, and we're talking about, in a related way, about Trump and female rage, anger against
basically,
Trump.
We're kind of talking about 2018, aren't we?
We are, although
what its flavour was.
We don't think it's going to finish 2018.
No, it's definitely not going to.
And then we're picking up an episode from Black Mirror, which we think is a Netflix show which really has a window on the contemporary soul. For argument's sake, where we take a debate, cut out the party politics and try to talk it out. So, Franklin Graham's coming, Megan.
Who is Franklin? That said it all already, didn't it?
You sounded very concerned. Who is Franklin Graham? Why is he coming?
So, he's Billy Graham, who... Billy Graham has been described as sort of the evangelical glue, or the
evangelical
most significant...
Pope, I heard.
Yes. Most significant either evangelical or Christian figure in the 20th century. So, I mean, we all love Billy. I went to the 1979... Crusade.
I didn't because it wasn't in Australia, but my parents, my uncle and my father became Christians in 1959 at the Billy Graham Crusade, which many Christian leaders of that generation.
Yeah, so.
It was formative for them.
Formative, yeah. Well, for me, it wasn't. I just remember the buses. I was five.
Oh,
but I did go. They were great buses. Look, you love buses when you're five. Anyway, so Franklin Graham is Billy Graham's son.
Yeah, and before we talk about him, though, it should be said that what Billy was able to do in evangelism was he was able to get Christians, unite them behind him.
Well, what I was saying about evangelical glue, that he, not just evangelicals, but he managed to sort of get a whole lot of people on side because he really wanted to prioritise people coming to know Jesus.
So there were even Baptists involved in the first Billy Graham Crusade in Australia. Actually, he's a Baptist, so of course they were. But there were even Anglican, he had one of the Anglican bishops sort of chairing his the committee that was, you know, so it was really cross-denominational.
That
which
was
is
really
unusual.
Important to him, yeah.
Really unusual and really important. And so there was this sort of unity of purpose. But his son, Franklin Graham, is coming.
Not creating the same kind of unity.
50 years after the 59 Crusade in 2019. And yet there's a bit of controversy. And it doesn't seem like he's really bringing everyone together. What's going on?
So we've had some... This is a bit of a Australian Christian Michael thing going on here. So you could join in. So Mike Frost has come out and been quite negative about him coming. I think he's had a couple of posts on that. Bring up Brett Kavanaugh and the division.
Mike Frost, who lectures at Moreland College in missiology.
Yes. And then Mike Bird, who lectures at another ACT college at Ridley. And he has
a very nice product placement.
Yeah, I know.
For the ACT there.
Watch that.
Mike Bird, yes.
Yes. And he wrote for the ABC a piece about why he's going to be boycotting Franklin Graham.
He's been pretty negative, and the reason is because Franklin Graham has been open in his support for Donald Trump. He's been very positive about Donald Trump, and he prayed at his inauguration, and
it's not so much that it was Trump, but the way he reacts to it. Because so to quote Mike Bird, he said, "Rather, my opposition is to Graham's idolatrous devotion to Trump, the way his." Messianized Trump to look like Jesus and Caesarized Jesus to look like Trump.
Now,
so it's his particular way that he interacts.
I've got to say, I'm very sympathetic to the views about the hesitancy about Franklin Graham. And someone at my church came up the other day and said, "Are we going to the Franklin Graham Crusade?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Why?" And I said, "Because I think he's too closely associated with Donald Trump." And they said, "Yes, but I like Donald Trump." So the conversation kind of didn't go much further there. Mm. But I felt this was a little bit of an overstatement. I couldn't find quotes which really were idolization. I thought that was a big call to make. I mean, Franklin Graham himself said that he didn't like either candidate in the last election.
Well, it's more kind of what he did. Actually, I want to pick this up because this has been a sort of volley of people from both sides in both the secular and Christian media, right?
Yeah.
So one of the people who came back in support of and replying to Mike Bird was Mark Powell, who's a Presbyterian?
Yeah, he's Presbyterian at Cornerstone Presbyterian.
Right.
In
Strathfield?
Yeah, Strathfield.
Yep, so he wrote in The Spectator and he brought up what he thought were problems with what
Mike Bird.
Mike Bird was saying, yeah. And I actually think he was completely off the mark. So he said, firstly, Graham doesn't see Trump as in any way being a saviour, especially a Messiah who is morally perfect. That is true, and that is actually a problem. Because...
yes, go on.
Because Franklin Graham has completely admitted to the moral failings of Trump, but refuses to see them as the problem that they, I think, that they are.
Yes, he sort of said, look, it's irrelevant. And he says also, just like Clinton, he says I was consistent. I'm not sure if he was, but he says I was consistent about Clinton's moral failings and about Brett Kavanaugh's moral failings, you know, that these are not relevant to the job you're doing or something like that. And he really wants to say, look, it's about getting, you know, gosh, I admit that this guy's not great and I don't see him as Christian and he's not going to give you the Christian presidency or anything like that, but he will nominate the right Supreme Court justices, which tells you something about what's in his head, I think, and that is that abortion is the key issue for him.
Yeah, I mean, that's really playing into all of it. I mean, the other thing that Mark Powell said was that Graham opposed Clinton not for the sexual indiscretion but because he covered it up. But we actually know also that it looks very clear that Trump has done that as well.
Oh, repeatedly, insistently, and then, but then also comes out and says,
it comes
well,
out
okay,
and owns it and
so
says,
what?
So what? Which also is a problem.
You're going to love me anyway.
So I really didn't think they were great comebacks to what's going on with Franklin Graham. I mean, I think that the problem with Franklin Graham is more than, but is connected to Trump.
Yes. Yeah, so hang on, you know, and back it up a little bit because I think Billy united the evangelical cause, yes. Billy was not apolitical. His father.
I mean, he did hang out with political leaders. He saw
and it
those.
Got complicated for him at various times, didn't it?
And he's not perfect. So, you know, he said some really helpful things in terms of racial reconciliation, but other things he said weren't as helpful. So
I want to say, if Franklin Graham had different politics, would you... Different politics as in he was just as political as he is, but he had different politics. Would you support him?
No. Although I don't think we can sort of so neatly pull out people's politics from who they are and what they're saying as Christians as if, yeah, because politics say something, you know, otherwise why would we bother with them?
Yeah.
But so my here are some problems with Franklin Graham. One is how there's been a huge issue over his salary.
His salary. Yep.
Yeah. So he takes or had, yeah, takes a salary. I'm not sure if this is completely up to date, but certainly has been the case on and off from both Samaritan's Purse, who he is like the head of, and also for the Billy Graham Association.
Yes. Is it an excessive salary in your view?
In my mind, yes. It's about, well, this is 2015, it was about $900,000.
Okay, that seems like a lot of money.
It does.
I mean, now I don't like that, and that seems appalling to me. But there is a cultural difference. I remember applying for a job in Dallas once, and they said, "I think you'll like the package." And I went, "Really?" Because we just get paid. It's pretty much the same wherever you go.
And we get awkward about talking about it.
In terms of ministers in Australia, yeah. It's a principle.
No, Anglicans get more than us. But anyway.
Well, yeah. we have to look after crumbly old buildings.
But it's not just because actually what he got for Samaritan's Purse was significantly like 40% above sort of equivalent. Like certainly they were getting paid quite a lot, the heads of charity organisations, but he was significantly above that again. And there were certainly calls from various people over time to say, why are you taking like full-time salaries for two roles?
Yes, yeah, and I hadn't heard that actually. So that is extremely concerning. But what was you
so that was
more.
That's a concern, and I think that fits in with some of the concerns I have with Trump, where it is about looking after the haves. There's a whole narrative there that connects in with that sort of connection of Christianity with power and wealth and so on. So I don't think they're disconnected, is what I'm saying.
Right, so okay, so you think there's a line from this kind of excessive salary to the political
yes, and what you think is important and how you think Christianity works in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Also, with Brett Kavanaugh, who was the Supreme Court justice that they want to get in because he was anti-abortion and so on, but there was a woman came out and said he's, you know, assaulted her, and Franklin Graham responded to that by saying that was irrelevant.
Yes, he said it was. He said, "Oh, we all did bad things when we were teenagers,"
which is just Sorry, that is, for me, that is appalling. That, you know, yes, I can think we can say we can have grace, we all learn, but there should be learning, there should be repentance.
No, there was no repentance from Kavanaugh. I mean,
no.
That's assuming he did it, but that you know, if that's true, Franklin Graham is assuming it's true and saying it doesn't matter.
Yes, that's right. He's saying irrelevant, which doesn't say I don't think it's true. It's saying, if it is true, it's irrelevant. And I find that deeply problematic.
Yes, without repentance and forgiveness on the part of the victim,
yes,
or anything like that.
Especially when that person is going to be making laws and judging other people. You know?
Higher standard.
I think so. I think that really applies here.
Okay, so is there anything else on that list?
Well, I do think the connection with Trump. So, and one of the things that I found, because Carl Faes, who I know is a Baptist minister who heads up Billy Graham Association here, said, oh, he won't be talking about Jesus in the rallies.
Politics. He will be talking about Jesus.
Oh, sorry. Yes.
Yes.
Misspoke there. So, but in fact, actually, he did a whole, during the election campaign in America, he did a whole thing called Decision America. That was his rallies that he did, which were about making a decision for Jesus. But, I mean, the link between that and the election was not accidental, I think. And he did talk about Trump and politics.
Yeah, he has used evangelistic crusades and put in a little political spin.
And he's even made
spin. It's not that
t-shirts,
it's political, it's that it's party political.
It's partisan.
It's partisan. Yeah. And I guess this is an awkward one, and I feel this is when I get into the pulpit, because I address in my congregation people with completely diametrically opposed political views.
Mm.
And I'm very conscious that I don't want people to come into the church, both non-Christians and Christians, to think that owning a particular set of political views is a condition of being a member of my church. You can be
absolutely, yeah.
You can have very, very right wing or very, very left wing.
I mean,
views.
You might want to challenge them on those views,
indeed,
and have a conversation with them about it.
Indeed, but I don't want to give
the impression that that's conditional. Yeah,
no, that's right. And I have to say, I don't know. I was thinking about this in the light of this. I think I suppress some of my own political views, and I don't tell people how I vote. Some people think they can guess, because I think, I would never join a political party. For exactly this reason, I think a minister of the gospel should remain aloof from that.
Because I have signed up to get emails from a few political parties, so I know what they're doing in my area. And because of that, I've actually been approached to run and be like, yeah, people think I should be in politics. It's a scary thought. But that's my thing, particularly when I was as a pastor, that I was like, I find that I can't align myself that closely to.
And you're in the North Shore, which is blue ribbon liberal.
That's not who was approaching me, but yes.
Yeah, but yeah. You would have given offence if you'd come out to people, and you might have.
I'm not so worried about giving offence, but I think, because I would be very open with how I voted if people talk to me about it, but I think that somehow putting my stamp of approval is a different thing, like to kind of too closely connect.
I'm just consciously aware that my politics are a factor sometimes of my faith, but sometimes of my prejudices and my tribe and my preferences and my economic views and my background. And I believe I'm right. I don't think I'm wrong. But I think they're not necessarily Christian, if you see what I mean. And I can appreciate that Christians have different.
Yeah, well, that's something, the complicated conversation that needs to happen.
Yeah.
But coming back to Franklin Graham, I think that there's, for me, there's a wisdom thing here. Is this what we should be taking our friends to? Is this what we think? Is this the events that we want to promote to our the people that we are leading?
Well, I've been interested that in talking to a Pentecostal pastor in my local area, and they're signed up. They're in. You know, it's
right.
Interesting. It's I don't think it'll cross his mind. Not to go. It was a sort of blissful unawareness. There's a big rally. We're gonna join in. Isn't it going to be fantastic? And yet, I was talking to another local Anglican minister, and we couldn't do it. I cannot endorse it.
Mm.
And partly, it's not. I'm not going to sort out the Franklin Graham situation. I have these concerns, but the concern that I have is that other people are concerned, deeply concerned, and that I just was reading 1 Corinthians 10 where Paul is saying, you know, don't give offence on peripheral things. You know, he's saying you don't want to put a barrier up.
Yeah.
So I there are many, many Australians who, hearing Franklin Graham's politics, just couldn't come, wouldn't, and I don't want Christianity associated with that politics.
And that's the thing, it's sort of keeping that association, which has been really a problem in terms of evangelicals voting for Trump and how people are feeling about what that says to us about Christians and what they're about. And because it's so connected with that, I think it's a pretty unwise thing. But I mean, you know, I'm not a ban the book kind of person. So like if people, you know.
So this is, I wanted to come back and put on the table for us to think about, yes, but what are we doing? I mean, at least the Billy Graham Association, they're running an evangelistic rally and they're trying to preach the gospel. And at one level, I really hope people become, I mean, not at one level, at every level, I hope people become Christians.
People become Christians through weird things.
Through the Franklin Graham tour.
Yeah.
And so, you know, at least they're putting something on. What are we going to do?
That's the challenge. Certainly I would do stuff in my own life, but I think maybe that's the challenge for us. If we're having a problem with this, what should we be doing instead? And how should we be putting a positive alternative up?
Yeah, I feel reluctant, and it's not a nice feeling to be feeling this reluctance about an evangelistic mission where the gospel's going to be proclaimed, even by a person who I think is compromised in this way. Now, before we get into our next segment, we really wanted you to do us a favour. Look, we're new, so if you want to keep listening, subscribe to the show on your favourite podcast
app.
Yeah,
and then you won't have to remember.
No, it'll just pop up.
It's really good for vague people like
me. It's really excellent. It would be really helpful if you can leave a review for the show on iTunes. But the right kind of review is what we're after. It helps other people find us.
Superlatives is what we're going for.
Really superlatives, that's right. In the sea of podcasts right now, this will help people to find us. And lastly, we want to continue the respectful conversation in the real world.
We've been enjoying what we've had so far.
Indeed. We've had a great time, in fact. So we'd love you to join us on the Eternity News Facebook page where you can keep talking about the things that we've been talking about here.
So we're coming back to our segment, Discomfort Zone, that I think people quite like, maybe not for good reasons, but where we say, ever thought someone might think differently if they went outside their comfort zone? This is where we make the other do just that. And I asked Michael to read the book, Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger by Rebecca Traister. And particularly, because it was very long, the section on Trump, because that connected with what we're saying today. So what was your reaction?
Oh well, it's an interesting book. It's a very readable book, and it got me thinking about anger and about the role of anger in any ethical political discussion. It's a book by a journalist, and so there's lots of storytelling and not a lot of analysis. I found so there isn't a sort.
It's not heavily footnoted.
No, but there's not a lot of it's not a lot of sort of let's sit and analyze what's going. And certainly, as much as I've read in it, there's a sort of there's an honesty to it because she's clearly a left-leaning woman, but she can see that anger in political life is actually vectoring from all sides of politics. It's actually anger led is not just on the sort of on the left where people are upset about Hillary Clinton failing, but actually there's
anger. She talks about Tea Party.
A real anger, and also there's a lot of women involved in the Tea Party.
Yes, she's not even saying that women just align with one particular type of anger. Yeah.
No, so there's the Tea Party anger, and also she noted that lots of white women, they say a majority of white women, voted for Trump. So that's a little bit of a...
Although she's really interesting connection of it's married white women that voted for Trump. She makes a point about that.
So there's a point about perhaps their votes were compromised in some way. But,
influenced.
But it's there, influence. It's there. It's still a fact there that anger in and of itself... and this is the problem in the book, I suppose, is that anger in and of itself is not good just because it's anger. You can be angry in all sorts of ways. You need a concept of what justice is.
Which I found some of the reviews of the book that they didn't really pick up, that I think she was more nuanced on that than people were thinking. They possibly hadn't really read the book. because she does, and she talks about the fact that female anger, there's a very difficult dance that you've got with that of, because people don't like women's anger in the main, how you use that anger. Yeah.
So that was her thing was... women's anger is unpalatable and yet it's a very dynamic force for change.
I mean, I think she made that quite well. Like, I found that really interesting that she was saying, look, here's a whole lot of examples in history where women's anger has been sort of a catalyst for really incredibly important social change.
So, I don't want to sound like this is a typical political move. But I'd say, well, some women, you know, it's interesting to kind of come up with a class and a gender as a class, which is almost like it's difficult to do. And I think on the progressive side, that people find themselves then dividing, and she does it too, quite honestly, dividing between, first of all, white women and black women, and then saying, actually, there are people on the left side. There are just as many misogynists on the left side of politics. The men on the left are just as bad as the men on the right. They are bad as well as the men on the right.
She says something really interesting about that too, that in terms of all the oppressed groups, that women are a majority oppressed group. And that gives a particular quality to any women's movement.
A particular quality.
Yeah, that therefore it's going to be very multivalent. It's going to have tensions within it and so on. That's the outcome of oppressing a majority group.
I'm only posing it as a question, but the idea that you have solidarity with women everywhere, is that really an idea that works? I mean, is it a truth, or is it? Is that even possible?
I had someone talking to me about that, about a post that I made recently, and it's more possible than you think. I know certainly with the Me Too movement, which Tracer talks about, that my experience about that in talking with women, not when men were around, but speaking with women, is there is a massive feeling of solidarity about it, that because these are, wherever you're coming from on any kind of spectrum, these are shared experiences. Like we've all experienced them, and we all know women who've experienced them. But there is, and what I think you see with the Me Too, and what you're saying was sort of definitive of this movement and this moment in time, is that women have found each other. They've found that commonality, perhaps in a way that previously they were divided.
Well, I'd say some women have. I don't want to be narky. I mean, just a lot of women have.
Yeah, I mean, look, you're never going to get 100% of anything, are you? But it's a significant number of women. And my experience of talking to women across the spectrum when men are not around, see, I'm being very careful to say that to you, is a lot of sisterly feeling about it that I haven't experienced before.
Yeah, and that's what, in one sense, she's pointing to a history of moments in which that sisterly feeling arises. Mm. I wanted to talk also about her definition of anger, because I think she does talk about a philosopher called Martha Nussbaum in the book. Martha Nussbaum is a bit of a... I'm a bit smitten by Martha Nussbaum. She's a great philosopher and also just very interesting. She uses lots of stories in her philosophy, and I like that as a former English teacher. And Nussbaum defines anger as the desire for payback. And she kind of points to something in anger as being retributive, a feeling of that I was wrongfully treated about something I cared about, and I don't just want a new thing, a new status of affairs to take place. I actually want vengeance, or I want.
And there is, so I have a couple of responses to that. First is, I think there's more in the Bible about vindication than we sometimes are comfortable with admitting. That vindication is something that's seen as necessary, that people need to have justice seen to be happen for them.
Yes.
Yeah.
So Nussbaum thinks, following from Aristotle, that anger is then morally bad because it wants vengeance. But I would say biblically, I wanted to then say, the Bible actually is not, you know, vengeance or retribution or
vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, but there's still vengeance in it, that sense. It's still something that needs to happen.
It's still there. It's just given to God. It's kind of God hears the cry, hears the anger. And then so I wanted to say, would we agree that anger is morally bad?
Yeah, I had a really interesting experience. I thought this was a really important book, even though there's some flaws in it. But one of them was my experience of, I'm a woman who totally took on board, I find my own anger really hard to access. I tend to get sad, which she talks about that dynamic in the book. Mm-hmm. And my public presence is not an angry one. Sometimes you'll see
when
private
presence.
When we switch
the microphone off, oh my goodness me.
So I really, and certainly I find male anger scary.
When do we see male anger?
A lot. Well, the Kavanaugh story is really interesting because Brett Kavanaugh got very angry in the hearings that they had about whether he could become a Supreme Court justice. Christine Blasey Ford, who was accusing him, she could not do that. Like, that was an option that was not open to her. And that's not talked about in the book because the book came out just a few days before that.
Right.
So but it certainly is the kind of thing she's talking about. So male anger has often been seen as a righteous or a change agent in a way that female anger hasn't, I think. I think that's really useful. Yeah. So I do think because we identify masculinity with the performance of anger, that has become a problem in our society.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, have we identified masculinity with the performance of anger? I mean, I don't understand. I don't recognise that in, We see its horrible excesses in domestic violence situations, of course, male frustration and anger. But in a lot of situations, I find men kind of emotionally mute. That's the we are not, you know, it in the face sometimes of a female anger that's articulate, you know, extremely articulate. I think that's a domestic situation that many men would recognize.
Yeah, look, and the relationship between a husband and wife, you know, plays out differently, although related to how society plays out male and female relationships and the general trends of masculinity and femininity. So that's complicated. But I do think she's correct that we find more anger more allowable in men, and that causes issues. So anger is it is a complex. Like, I have a whole lot of mixed feelings about anger. Yeah, and I do think female anger is necessary, but I do hear a lot of men who are saying, oh, this has gone too far, and they're really, really uncomfortable with the female anger that's being expressed. Now, I think they need to work that through, but I personally try to express things in a way that is going to be able to communicate and get through people's defences.
So I was going to say, the trouble with anger is that anger is, as I said, it's morally neutral. I mean, Nussbaum says no, morally bad, but it can be misdirected anger, or it can also be incoherent or unarticulate anger, or it's looking for some kind of object. And the trouble is, if the object's not right, injustice can be done in the name of justice. You know, untruths can be said in the name of truth, and yet it could motivate change in a positive direction if channeled, but that. The channeling is the key thing. Having a clear moral vision is the right thing. Having a clear sense of one's own of what the injustice of what justice is and how it's being missed. And I think too, anger can come from a place where I'm right and you're wrong. It can sort of other.
Well, and that's a good and bad thing about anger, I think. I mean, I tend to be there. Oh, I always see this both sides of something. And yes, I think that's the problem with it. But also, I think that sometimes something is so important that we almost need to have anger to give us clarity about that. That sometimes in order to stop evil and injustice, we need a clarity at that point. And anger can sometimes bring us to that point.
So the emotion can focus. It is telling us something true sometimes.
Yes.
About the world.
Yeah. I mean, maybe that's we need to look at, like, what is our anger telling us and interrogate it a bit.
So I think One Nation, in our country, the One Nation movement is fueled by anger.
Mm.
A particularly nasty sort of petty, in my view, as a sort of elitist. You know, I kind of look down my nose at the One Nation voter because I think their views are silly. I think their leader is idiotic, and I, you know, but there's a sort of rage there, and there's rage on her face, and rage in her voice, and in her supporters against what they feel is a kind of taking away of their identity, or watering down, or a threat to their employment, which mostly is imagined. But
yeah, but there's something to be listened to there. I think And one of the responses is not to meet, necessarily always meet anger with anger, but to meet anger with listening. So often when I have someone meets me with anger, when I talk to them about it and I don't respond with anger, I don't necessarily respond with going, you're in the right, or I don't necessarily back down. But if I go and talk to them and I don't respond with anger, often I find more where it's coming from in a way that's really helpful for us and gets us somewhere.
So that's interesting because too, I guess we've just lost all our One Nation listeners, by the way. but the there were so many of them. The social media atmosphere does actually inflame angry responses one to the other. Tribalism, just anger meeting met with anger. I wondered if there are other ways, though, to sense injustice and respond with indignation towards connection and change. And I did think of Martin Luther King, and I don't sense in his great speeches anger. I sense actually. He actually treats those who the white audience with a kind of dignity and attempt to speak their language and connect with them and bring them along to appeal to their own sense of their own identity to use the American Constitution to change them, and that's a magnificent example.
Yeah, I mean, he's an amazing example with that. I guess, and what I'm trying to say is something very careful, which is I don't want to police other people's anger because it's often justified. I don't want to be quick to police it. But on the other hand, I want to meet the anger with a generosity and grace that can move us to somewhere beyond it.
Yeah, and that's what into hope, anger turned to hope. And I think the Christian, this is an interesting question then. For Christians, feeling anger, we do have the option of speaking to the God who delivers justice. And so we can then sort of take away the kind of the uncertainty and unclarity that sometimes anger brings, a fog to us.
And Psalms gives us good examples of angry prayer. Yeah. These people are my enemies.
Yes. Yeah. So we have a place in which to express our anger and a hope that that our cries for justice are heard, our cries against the world and our suffering is met.
Yes, anger is not the end.
Marg and Dave, reviews from two people obsessed by stories, but not always the same ones. And this time we're turning on Netflix once again. And
possibly addicted.
Yeah, absolutely. But I was asked I asked around when I first got Netflix, what should I watch? And someone said Black Mirror. You should watch Black Mirror. I was soon addicted. It's episodes, sort of sci-fi. And what's great about it is it's futuristic, but it's futuristic in the sense that it's just over the hill. It's kind of just
very near future.
Just around the corner. It's taking today's technology and just pushing it a little bit further, and going there. And this particular episode we wanted to look at is an episode called Nosedive. What's frightening about it is that what we see in that episode is almost coming true in China.
The Chinese social credit system. It's like they watched the episode
exactly.
And went, "Oh yes, fantastic!
What a great idea!"
Yeah.
So how's the Nosedive set up?
And I should say, actually, I'd watched a couple of episodes in Black Mirror and just been so distraught that I hadn't been watching it. But I did come back and watch Nosedive because you said it was
useful.
And I, again, found this actually a really confronting episode, but enjoyed it, if you like. So Nosedive is about sort of just into the future where social media people use, they've got eye implants, where they can immediately know who someone is.
Yes.
And be able to respond to them. And they've got mobile devices. People have constantly got their phone out.
Yeah, that sounds like
rating the anything future. That someone does.
Yeah. So it's like Uber. You rate your Uber taxi driver and he rates you.
On a 5-star scale,
that's
yeah.
It's like you rate everyone.
And then you can immediately see what people's ratings are. And
yes.
People have social outcomes dependent on their ratings.
Yeah. So if you're a consistent 4 average, then you're elite.
Yes.
You're allowed into clubs. You're allowed to,
and the
yes,
and some people get closed out because of going down too low.
That's right.
And the main character, played by Bryce Dallas Howard, beautifully. She, I like her. She's a 4.2 initially, but she wants to get into this sort of gated community.
Yes,
where she needs to. You know, it's going to be cheaper for her if she's a 4.5.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And she's got a friend who's sort of up in the 4.7s, 8s, 9s. And so the way you get up is because if you get someone who's got a higher rating, of course, you get them to rate you.
Yeah.
That's going to be great. They give you access.
Firstly, it had a lot to say about social media.
Yeah. I mean, and like all good sci-fi, it's actually not about the future. It's about the present.
Mm.
It had a lot to say about social media. And in what way?
I'm a real social media person, so I did find this something I was sitting there thinking about my own usage. But, you know, that sense of a very outwardly artificial construction of yourself where it's all about how other people are responding to what you're doing.
And your entire validation is based on how many likes you get, how many, how much attention you attract through the social media construction of yourself.
Yeah.
So you Instagram and there it is.
Yeah. I mean, I actually find this interesting that my nieces are my Instagram friend and they'll just like anything that I put up on Instagram. And I can see it's their way of subverting that. They're like, oh, Auntie Megan put up some bizarre, boring book from her work. Like, I'm just going to like it.
Because I don't really like it.
But I really need to affirm Auntie Megan because I don't want her to think that she was
so pathetic,
boring.
Yeah.
it tells us more than about social media because it talks about how society works and has always worked.
In a really nasty, it kind of exposes what we do.
Yeah.
In a really sort of nasty and craven and horrible way, doesn't it? Because we are extremely judgmental. We are extremely we are ruthless with one another.
We go around saying each other.
Yeah, exactly. We go around saying, "Oh, I don't, you know, I hate judgment. I really hate it when people judge other people." But we judge them all the time.
And I think this more than this, and he's coming, you know, my little left wing angle here. I think this had a lot to say about how power and privilege operates.
Go on.
So that, because, you know, her ranking falls and that puts her into an increasingly desperate situation. And I think and also the ranking, if you've got money, it's easier to have a high ranking for starters anyway. But even the ranking itself shows a type of privilege that you sort of get into a worse and worse position and quite quickly the more that you lose some vestiges of power and privilege.
Oh, that's the horrible descent that she experiences right down the scales just really quickly without...
And she's being judged and yet she's getting to a situation where it's very hard for her to move in any other direction. And that is, as a society, that in all sorts of ways people have types of power and privilege that other people don't and can be very difficult to act against that.
There is an interesting aspect too is that the people at the top of the tree can get a little bit more by helping someone below them, but they've got to do it very carefully. So, you know, there is a sort of room for charity, but it has to be done in the right way. You can't...
And if you slip too far, you'd be below charity. You're no longer a deserving...
That's right. And also the upper people don't want to get too embroiled because then they'll get sucked down too.
So I thought it was too simple to see this as like an anti-social media message. I think it was a message about how we interact with other people, how people make their way in the world, what's important to us.
So, there are obvious sort of responses in the gospel. The ways in which the gospel is sort of an antidote to this is just that we're really crap at actually living it out, I think, in the church. People feel like when they walk into the church, they're going to be evaluated and judged because that's how we feel entering a new community of people.
Mm.
But you feel... Particularly James came to mind where, you know, actually there's a sort of reversion of the scale. You put the poor person up the front and the rich person down the back.
And Christians
don't pay attention to the rich person.
Sort of one of the things that was seen unacceptable about early Christianity was the blending of the social classes.
Getting slaves meeting with...
Yeah, like that was, you know...
Masters.
Sort of too revolutionary. And yet that's something that I think sometimes, we drift away from and we get too easily... tribalised in our Christianity as well.
Yeah, I find this in the evangelical movement in the attempt to make church a comfortable place to be, we fall into the way the market segments parts of society. So we've got, this is the old people's service, this is the young people's service, this is the middle-aged people's service, this is the women aged 30 to 33 service.
I'm going to go into the inner city and do the trendy people. I'm going to go into the inner city and do the homeless people, not do that together.
Yes, because, you know, this is the place for hipster beards. This is the place for nerds.
This is the place for other kind of beards.
Other kind, just scraggly beards.
Yeah. There's a beard ranking.
There's a beard yeah, beard qualification.
But there is. That's I completely, and what are we saying? That is not giving us a glimpse of the age to come. That's not what the church should be like.
No, but it's very easy to be romantic about that because there's, you know, when we all get together, it's really, and we're diverse, it's really, really difficult.
It's hard, yeah.
I mean, seriously difficult. It trying to get people who are 90 to agree with people who are 19 and have anything in common with them is really quite difficult. There's a lot of intolerance between those. I mean, this is just age groups.
Yeah.
But also between social classes, it's very difficult.
And yet we don't walk away from it because it's difficult.
Well, we ought not.
We ought not, yes.
But we feel, I suppose we feel like outsiders will come in and go, oh, that person's actually awkward and they smell.
Well, I mean, I kind of say that to my children.
I'm like, they're not talking about the minister, by the way.
Sometimes.
They're not talking about the minister.
When I've had a hard weekend. I kind of, you know, like some people look at them and I think, well, at least they've got a place in the church. You know, like the church should have awkward people in it.
Well, it certainly does.
That's a great place to stop.
Yeah, we have a particularly room for them. They can all go in and be awkward together. No, it really does. And I often feel like sometimes the awkward person is the person who comes up to the new person. And I think, oh, really? Does the awkward person have to talk to the new person? And I think, no. The new person needs to know that actually we're a place in which we have...
You're not as awkward as this person. You're going to be welcome.
That's right. Yeah. And I think that's the judgy thing. I think actually everyone thinks Christians are going to be more judgmental. Actually, we really should be. And I think often not half as judgmental as the world outside where there's this constant, remorseless, ruthless judgment and evaluation and a use of shame to belittle people all the time.
And to come back to social media, therefore, I'm not an advocate of coming out of it, but rather trying to be that salt and light within it and show a different way.
Me too. I mean, you know, neither of us actually exist. We wouldn't exist if we didn't have social media.
With All Due Respect is hosted by Michael Jensen and me, Megan Powell-Dutoit. This episode was produced by Alex Bennett and the sound design was done by Adam Jones. You can subscribe to With All Due Respect on iTunes, Spotify, or any of the other places that you get your podcasts. And you can help us out by rating and reviewing the show on iTunes. That really helps other people find out about us. Check out our show notes if you want to take a closer look at anything that we've talked about on today's podcast. You can find them at attorneynews.com.au/respect. And you can come and be part of the respectful conversation with us and all the other listeners over on the Attorney News Facebook page.